It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Congress held a House Oversight and Accountability Subcommittee hearing on Wednesday on the topic of UFOs, officially referred to as Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena, or UAP. The hearing included claims by a former Air Force intelligence officer that the Pentagon had been concealing recovery and reverse engineering programs. Glenn Grothman is the U.S. House representative from Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. He chaired that hearing. I talked to him this morning.
Yeah, what led to this subcommittee meeting on these unidentified anomalous phenomena?
Well, we had a couple of congressmen who were very adamant that they wanted to have a hearing. There's a congressman who hasn't come forward yet, but he told me he had seen one of these things when he was a child. So given that there were a couple of very passionate congressmen who wanted this hearing, we decided to give it to them.
What were some of the main serious takeaways? Are there policy changes you'd like to see in the military when it comes to how they collect this information from their personnel and what they do with it?
Well, I'll tell you, I last visited this, I'm not kidding, in middle school. And I read a long book, and it was kind of like today. There were a small number of people who said they saw what at the time we called UFOs. And they felt the government wasn't taking it seriously, and a lot of people were seeing them but weren't coming forward for fear of ridicule. And at the time, the government said, well, we can't divulge this for national security reasons. We've got all these closed files. People can't look at them. It was the same thing on Wednesday. We had two naval pilots there who both said they and other pilots at the same time saw these UAPs. One said he saw what they call a tic-tac, like the little breath mint, something that shape, but obviously much bigger, flying very rapidly, doing maneuvers that a normal airplane couldn't do. And there was another naval pilot over the Atlantic who said he saw a spherical-like thing, and inside the sphere was a big black box. They said that I could, and I eventually will, sometime in the next month and a half, receive a confidential briefing on whatever they can't tell me about publicly. But secondly, I think there should be legislation saying that they have to release these files eventually. I mean, it went through a period in the, like I said, the late 1960s, the early 70s, in which there was a lot of rumors that these things were out there. As far as I know, to this day, the files are not released on what pilots saw in the 60s and 70s. So I think if you go back 15 years or whatever, these things should be released. And then we'll know more whether there's something credible. I mean, I don't want to say that these aren't credible. We heard ourselves from two naval pilots who claimed they had a lot of other pilots who saw strange things that were executing maneuvers that a normal aircraft couldn't execute. So I think the big thing is a little more transparency from the military.
One key here is people hear these unexplained aerial phenomena and think, you know, aliens, something from another planet. The key here is, it seems to me, Representative Grothman, is pilots are seeing something out of the ordinary. Often we find out it had earthly origins. But if there's something up there, we don't know what it is. National security-wise, it's worth at least looking into. Is that fair to say?
Oh, no question. I mean, you have to wonder, is it something that other nations have developed that we are nowhere near developing? I mean, we ought to know that. And if it is something from outer space and there are other people monitoring us, well, we ought to know that, right? And like I said, it's not just two pilots. It's two pilots claiming a variety of pilots have seen it. They will say that commercial pilots are afraid to come forward for fear of ridicule or for fear that one of the big airlines won't let them fly for them anymore. So I'd be kind of curious as to see what they're going to tell me in a closed setting. And I think the public ought to know, because the public's interested. You know, we can kind of say what a strange thing to have a hearing on, but I'll tell you, I've received more phone calls on this and more press attention than I have for all the hearings I've held, what's going on at the border. I'm trying to show that there's some waste in military spending to hold down the deficit here. I get more calls on this. There's certainly a lot of public interest as well.
Do you think it's deserved public interest? I mean, you listed some other really important issues. Does this get disproportionate attention, even from us here at Public Radio giving you a call about it?
Well, right. We haven't called from you guys in a while, so that's illustrative of something by itself. I think, and I would like to maybe talk to some other pilots, but if there are a couple dozen people who have seen things high up in the sky going at rapid rates and stopping on a dime, and I mean, let's face it, if that's true, that's incredibly significant, isn't it? I mean, you can throw all the other headlines out in the paper for the last year. If we're being visited from another galaxy, I guess that's the news story of the year.
So what are the next steps on this? You've had this public hearing. You mentioned some private meetings, maybe some legislation. What does the timeline look like there?
Well, I think we'll have, to be honest, the legislature is leaving now. This is the one a year, 5 or 6 week out of Washington. But when I come back, I will meet with this guy, Gresh, and see what more he has to say. I do think we should pass legislation going back, say, maybe 20 years that the or 15 years that the military has to divulge or open up their files on this sort of thing so people can make up their mind, and maybe establish some permanent sort of agency as a depository for people who, like I said, see this type of thing. They are claiming that commercial pilots see this stuff as well.
I just wonder if should there be room in this legislation if the Pentagon says, okay, maybe some of our people are seeing some of the stuff that some of our other people are doing that we're not ready to roll out to the public. Is there room for some classification where they don't reveal this information to the public?
That would be their argument. That would be their argument that and that even the pictures or the abilities of our own jets that are taking pictures, we don't want to reveal that. Those are the arguments that are out there, that there's stuff that we may have that we don't want to tell other countries about. But if it was something that we had 30 years ago or 20 years ago, I would think by now, unless they have a really good reason, I don't know why the whole public can't see this. And even though, because of the hearing, we are having articles on this today, this stuff has been around a long time, right? And maybe it hasn't, Congress hasn't had hearings on it, but the idea that certain pilots are saying that they see this strange stuff has been around, like I said, since I was in elementary school.
And Representative Grothman, as you mentioned, you'll be in your district now for a handful of weeks. People might be contacting you about this issue. What issues are you hoping to hear from your constituents about over the next month and a half?
Well, we are working on the budget. And to be honest, people come forward and give me stories that I think are relevant either to spending less or spending more in a variety of areas. So that's certainly one place I like to hear from people on.
Representative Grothman, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
That was Glenn Grothman, U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 6th Congressional District. I talked to him earlier today about a congressional hearing on UFOs and government transparency. UFOs aren't just in the news, they're in Wisconsin, apparently. This weekend, the village of Elmwood will hold their 44th annual Elmwood UFO Days to commemorate the many reported UFO sightings in their area. Amy Beckel is president of the Elmwood Community Club, which organizes Elmwood UFO Days. I talked to her earlier today.
Now, can you talk about Elmwood's connection with UFOs? What makes Elmwood the UFO capital?
Since the 70s, or in the at least during the 70s, there's been lots of sightings. Our local cop at the time, he had a sighting, is probably one of the more famous ones. A family that was traveling back from relatives had an encounter where a ship followed them down the road. Multiple other people have seen strange activities, ships, large glowing objects, good upstanding people in our community. So,
and what made Elmwood embrace that to become the UFO capital and host UFO Days?
They were looking for, I suppose, a way to bring activity to the businesses and stuff. And I assume that's when most of the towns were starting to do their celebrations. I see a lot of 40 and 50 year town festivals taking place. So So I suppose they thought that maybe they should do that too, bring some business to town. And they had put out a request form. People could give ideas, suggestions for a name for the festival. And somebody suggested UFO Days. And it's been UFO Days since the very first festival in 1978. And we've kept it. There was talk probably 6-7 years ago. Some of the people, they thought that maybe we should change it, that they didn't like that wasn't a good representation of us. But the younger generation, they're like, no, that's what we're known for. People love the name, and it's unique. They recognize us, and there's not many that have an interesting theme to go along with their festival.
I was looking at the list of events for UFO Days and for the UFO Festival, and, you know, there's music and there's food, but what kind of unique UFO things do you have this weekend?
This year we were approached by several new speakers. We have our tried and true, Daniel Lancaster. He's coming back. And Bill Johnson usually does a presentation, but he's out with some health issues this year. But we'll be back next year because it's nothing concerning or whatever. But we were approached by Sarah Como, I think is how you say it. She is a cosmic ambassador, and she called us in January, and she wanted to get involved. And then since her call, we were approached by an author, Danielle Gay. She's coming and doing a book signing. MUFON from Minnesota has reached out, and they'll be here. They're also doing a presentation. Let's see. And Adrian Lee, he's coming. He has a paranormal show, Twin Cities Way. So he's relatively well known. And then this is the, let's see, fifth year that we've done our bus tours. We started that for the 40th anniversary and thought that's where it would end. We would offer the bus tours to go to some of the local sightings, talk about what was seen and who saw them. And then we didn't give it much thought. You know, it was the 40th anniversary. We'll do it for that. And then just kind of put it by the wayside. Well, as the 41st anniversary drew closer, then we were being approached and said, well, hey, are you doing the bus tours again? And so at that point, then the committee that's like, well, we better think about this because people are now asking, what do you think? So now it's just become part of our festival.
We'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
All righty. Thank you.
That was Amy Beckel, president of the Elmwood Community Club. I talked to her about the 44th annual Elmwood UFO Days Festival starting today and running through the weekend. Up next, find out why video games are becoming a more common educational tool. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Imagine you're a young journalist who gets your first job at a newspaper in a small Midwestern town. Your first assignment, cover the local cherry festival. But then a catastrophic flood comes through town, throws the whole community into chaos. You got to trek through high waters and make the right connections around town to keep your public well informed. That's the premise of the new computer game Headlines and High Water, created by UW-Madison's Field Day Lab, which designs educational video games for students to learn various subjects. Labs created 20 games and counting, plus other learning tools with virtual and augmented reality. Sarah Gagnon is the creative director for the Field Day Lab in the Wisconsin Center for Education Research at the UW-Madison School of Education. I talked to her earlier this year. Talk us through this new Headlines and High Water game. What do students do when they sit down and start playing?
Yeah, well, this game is a text-based adventure game, and so you take on the role of a young journalist. And just kind of like one of those choose your own adventure books that we play, like we read when we were kids, you kind of do that. But then it also has like extra things that kids are used to, like stats and like a story builder mechanic. So you play a series of six stories, and you'll have to construct a story at the end of each one.
What are you hoping students take away from this? And what age range are you shooting for here?
I mean, I really think the story is pretty like broad. Like we've seen fourth and fifth graders play it, and we've seen adults play it and have fun. But we made this for middle school because I was working with Sue Robinson, who is at the UW School of Journalism and Mass Communication, as the partner for this. And we were talking a lot about how schools, like kids have access to news earlier and earlier, but there's not a lot of like journalism or media literacy classes that are devoted to that until high school. So we were excited about making this for middle school kids.
Can you talk about the value of using video games for education in the first place?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, you know, we can ask ourselves whether or not video games are good or bad. And there's like a lot of different opinions about that. And I think a lot of them are valid. We kind of approach it from a little bit of a different point of view, which is that's where kids are. Kids are playing video games and kids like video games. And so we want to be where kids are. That's kind of our theme. We want to go where they're going. Games also have really interesting affordances, like you can fail and it can be fun, unlike taking a test and failing. In our game, you can fail in all kinds of ways. Like you can run out of time to write your story. Someone else can scoop you, or you can actually get lost in the flood and never make it to where you're trying to go. So all of those things are funny. You can start over. But the main thing is this is what kids are doing these days. And we want to be there making them beautiful, artful, really well-informed material.
I was a kid once upon a time and in some of the earlier days of computing. And I don't know, sometimes there are educational games that felt too educational. Like this is just school in a computer game form. How do you try to make it so kids are having fun and not necessarily raising their educational alert hackles?
Oh, I know. That's like the big thing you just said is that we actually have a saying in learning games design that some games are like chocolate covered broccoli, which means that, you know, you're like dipping it, yeah, putting some honey on it, whatever. So what we've done is at Field Day, as a creative director, I think of ourselves as artists who make games for learning. So first and foremost, we come at it with incredible art, incredible story. And then, you know, we have to like cover all these topics. But first and foremost, I think of myself as an artist, which means we try to make things beautiful. We work with real writers. And by real, I don't mean that video game writers aren't real, but we work with artists who are kind of from outside of the video game industry and outside of the education fields, so that we're really thinking about people who are amazing storytellers or great game designers first and foremost. So I don't think learning has to be not fun, but sometimes you know, sometimes it can be difficult. So it's a challenge.
Now, headlines in high water, that's journalism and media literacy. What are some of the other topics you've tackled in games at the lab?
Yeah, so we've done some history games. We had a game that came out last year called Legend of the Lost Emerald. We worked with the Wisconsin History Museum or Society, History Society. And that one is about shipwrecks around the Great Lakes. And so that one is set for fourth grade. We have a game called Lakeland that has to do with like phosphorus and the dairy industry. We just came out with another game this year about oceanic science called Wake, Tales from the Aqualab. And so our games are anywhere from like fourth grade all the way into university level.
And part of the goal, of course, is to get people actually using these. How do you make them available to schools or the public?
Yeah, that is the goal. We work with some of the leading researchers around the country and here at the UW to get these out. So one of the ways is making sure the art is beautiful. We partner with a lot of distribution partners, including like public media. So these games get between 5,000 and 15,000 plays a month. And that's because they're free, because we have distribution partners around the country. So you can go to our website, or you can go through like BrainPop or Wisconsin Public Media, and that's, yeah, so that's how we get it out there.
What kind of feedback do you get at the lab from teachers and maybe even students who have used these games as learning tools?
Yeah, we work with teachers to make the games, and they test them in their classrooms. And so we get great feedback, like, oh, this game is so addictive, I want to keep playing it. And we also get feedback like, why did you even make this thing? Or my advice is this game shouldn't exist. One of my favorite pieces of feedback was, why isn't this game Fortnite? And so, but we also get very, like, so, you know, there's like whole ranges, but we get all through the making of the game, incredible feedback from the teachers about how long it needs to be or what works and doesn't work in their classroom. And yeah, I mean, of course, the stuff I love hearing is how much they love it. That's my favorite stuff. But we always try to like use that feedback to, you know, impact the design to make sure that they really work for teachers.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That was Sarah Gagnon, Creative Director for the Field Day Lab in the Wisconsin Center for Education Research at the UW-Madison School of Education. I talked with her last spring about the educational video games her lab creates for students. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, there are lots and lots of ads out there for gold coins targeting seniors in particular. And in some cases, that's putting their retirement savings at risk. We'll check out the results of a new investigation into gold marketed toward older Americans. And the Inflation Reduction Act put a cap on out-of-pocket insulin costs for Medicare recipients. Did that lead to more people getting the medication they need? A Wisconsin expert digs into the change and what it means for people with diabetes. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. First, much of the country is still in the midst of a massive heat wave, and it's reaching us here in Wisconsin with the temperature creeping into the 90s in the southern half of the state. But even within communities, not everyone experiences heat waves in the same way. A new report digs into the concept of urban heat islands, where certain parts of cities are significantly hotter during heat waves. The analysis from the organization Climate Central finds that about 41 million Americans in cities across the U.S. live in these urban heat islands. People living and working in those areas have higher energy costs, worse air pollution, and higher rates of heat-related illness and mortality. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a city? Have you noticed that parts of your community are hotter than others? Do you see solutions in your area? How prepared do you think your community is for climate change and higher temperatures? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Peter Gerard leads digital communications and media relations for Climate Central. That's a climate change research organization. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me today.
Can you give us an overview of what your organization found when you looked at these heat islands across cities across America?
We were able to look at a neighborhood by neighborhood analysis of how the built environment makes residents feel even hotter than temperatures that are you know, soaring this summer. And we found that in a number of places, in virtually every city we looked at, temperatures were anywhere from 8 to 12 degrees hotter than they ordinarily would be because of the built environment, because of the characteristics of some of these neighborhoods.
And I got to say, I've had experiences where I thought, oh, this part of whatever city is hotter than this one, just, you know, walking 5 blocks or something like this, and assumed it was all in my head, honestly. No, it really can vary that much within, you know, one community like that.
It was not in your head. As you walk through different environments, you're going to go through areas where you've got more shade, where there are more parks, where there are buildings with darker building materials, where there are paved surfaces that are radiating heat back at you. And these are the kinds of changes that residents experience. And it is literally hotter in the places where you've noticed these pockets of you know, what seems to you to be radiating heat.
Let's take a look at the one city in Wisconsin you looked at. That's Milwaukee. A significant portion of the city has these heat islands. What did you see there?
It varies. You've got, and this is not dissimilar from other cities, you've got this sort of checkerboard approach where some neighborhoods are clearly showing these built environment traits that are amplifying heat. And in some cases, it's 6, 7, 8 degrees. In some cases, it's even more than that of extra heat. because of these characteristics of the neighborhood that they're walking through or living in.
It may not sound like a lot, 6 or 7 or 8 degrees, but over the course of a hot day and a hot night in a heat wave, how much difference can that make when it comes to our well-being?
It can be the difference between uncomfortable and dangerous. This is a significant human health threat. And, you know, when you have people who are experiencing temperatures in the 80s and 90 degrees, when you have these neighborhoods that aren't cooling down overnight, where it's 75 or 80 degrees overnight, it coincides with increased emergency room visits. It is placing people who have heart conditions or asthma and other respiratory conditions at greater risk. It's particularly tough on the elderly and on the very young. So it's not just uncomfortable. These urban heat islands, these hot neighborhoods, it's putting their residents at greater health risk.
We are talking about the concept of urban heat islands. Peter Gerard is with us from the group Climate Central. They did an analysis of cities all over the U.S., including Milwaukee here in Wisconsin, found, depending on how neighborhoods are built, a pretty wide range of temperatures when things heat up during heat waves. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences in a community here in Wisconsin or elsewhere. Have you seen that kind of variation? What kind of changes in a community do you think could help make a difference? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Peter, let's visit some of our Midwestern neighbors. What did you find in places like Chicago and Minneapolis?
It's really interesting. So Chicago has a surprisingly high percentage of its neighborhoods and therefore its population experiencing 10 degrees or more of additional heat because of the built environment in which they live. Almost 500,000 people in Chicago are experiencing this 10 degree temperature increase, which is really significant, and it amplifies exactly the health risks that I talked about. And then when you look at Minneapolis, if you look at 8 degrees, which is still a relatively high threshold of additional heat, nearly half the people living in Minneapolis or the urban areas surrounding it are experiencing that kind of additional heat. So both cities, obviously different sizes, but they're experiencing some of that same urban heat island effect that's exposing some but not all residents to additional heat.
What are you hoping people in charge or decision makers in cities, I think probably even smaller communities, can do with this information? Are there things we can do to change that built environment and hopefully limit the impact of these heat islands?
There are, and they're not all expensive sort of, generational projects where you're rebuilding or rezoning a city. Some of them are really simple. One of them is plant trees. One of the characteristics of neighborhoods where you see these urban heat islands, elevated temperatures, is often fewer trees, less shade, less grass, fewer impermeable surfaces or permeable surfaces. They're more paved, and changing some of those characteristics makes a difference. Lighter colors make a difference. Building materials, and then in kind of larger ways, roofs are one of the most significant contributors to this urban heat island effect. You can think about dark colored, roofs that are attracting heat instead of radiating it. And in some cities, light colored and reflective roofing materials are making a difference. So are rooftop gardens and what they call green roofs, where an entire roof is planted. On a neighborhood level, this can make an amazing difference.
I don't know if your report goes into this, but are there communities that are prioritizing these kinds of changes?
We know about some anecdotal stories and some evidence sort of here and there, but on a broad scale, and we didn't explore it as part of this analysis, but on a broad scale, I don't know that it's happening in an organized or government-driven way.
Now, as I understand it, within communities, not everybody is affected equally by these heat islands. People with a lower income, often people of color, more likely to be in these heat islands. What did you see across the country when you looked at these maps of cities?
One of the first things we looked at was where the neighborhoods were and what some of the characteristics of the neighborhoods were where we're seeing this additional heat. And although it's not part of the analysis, we have looked, and this urban heat islands is something that we've studied for a couple of years now. There is absolutely a correlation between redlined neighborhoods, neighborhoods where banks weren't lending to homeowners, and they're typically black and brown and lower income communities. They frequently show the characteristics that show up in the urban heat island analysis. They're hotter.
I want to get into another consequence here. We focus some on the health impacts of being in a heat island. Energy costs, obviously, if our neighborhood is hotter, if we have air conditioning, we're going to run it more. That's going to, well, generate more climate change pollution, and it's going to cost people more to keep up with those temperatures. How big an impact does that have?
It's meaningful, and it's particularly meaningful when you think about the correlation between lower income neighborhoods and these neighborhoods with elevated heat. The people who can least afford a big electric bill are often those who need to spend more to keep their homes cool.
And if they have air conditioning in the first place, and this is another big difference, possibly people at the most risk here may not have AC in the first place. Is that another part of the concern?
Absolutely it is. There are people who don't have air conditioning or who can't keep an air conditioning maintained. If an air conditioner breaks in some cities during really hot spells, that's not merely uncomfortable. That's a significant health risk.
Talking to Peter Girard with Climate Central. That's an organization that recently conducted an analysis on urban heat sinks, these heat islands in cities around the country. Coming up, we'll also hear from a Wisconsin researcher who took a close look at the impact of heat islands in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you, your neighborhood, or parts of your community particularly hot during heat waves? When you walk, bike, or drive in your neighborhood, do you see lots of green or lots of gray? That can tell a big story about how your neighborhood absorbs heat. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about urban heat islands. A Milwaukee citizen science project last summer found that there can be up to a 10-degree difference between the hottest and coolest parts of the city. Now we're taking a look at how heat islands work, what causes them, what cities can do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your observations in your own community. That's 800-642-1234. Peter Girard stays with us from Climate Central. Now, Woonsup Choi is an associate professor in the Department of Geography at UW-Milwaukee. He's done research on heat islands in the Milwaukee area. Woonsup, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
In your research, Woonsup, where did you find in Milwaukee the worst kind of heat islands? What stood out to you?
What stood out to me was the very high temperature at night with high humidity, the uncomfortable city.
I think we've got a bad connection with Woonsup. I'm sorry about that. We'll see if we can find another way to connect with you. We've got Peter Girard still with us from Climate Central in the meantime. Let's bring on a caller now. Dwayne is with us in Cudahy. Dwayne, hi.
I'm wondering, when are we going to stop building up and start building down? You go down in the basement, it's nice and cool down there. If this heat gets out of control and we can't make it cooler easily, we can go down.
Dwayne, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Peter Girard from Climate Central, the idea of finding refuge from the heat and natural cooling with our basements by doing more underground. What do you think?
You know, I think you're getting at 2 points. I mean, your one is you're clearly right, and you're gaining a benefit of being closer to the ground. The other thing is, in our study, one of the characteristics of urban heat islands is building height. It's a hard thing to change in a city that's been built, but you see this with cities like New York and Boston and the East Coast. You see it in Chicago. You know, that building height is making a difference. It's actually making it hard for airflow to cool down the surface. So the idea of changing the way you construct buildings and using more of the underground and less of the above ground, it's consistent with ways that you could live in a warming city.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dwayne, at 800-642-1234. Gene is with us calling from On the Road. Gene, hi.
Good afternoon. I'd like to reemphasize the tree planting portion to increase the urban canopy overall and also improve the infrastructure to facilitate that and prolong the average lifespan of urban trees. They're a value not only for, you know, heat islands and cooling, but health and psychological well-being as well. Thank you.
Oh, Gene, hang on, actually. This sounds like you've something you've thought about a lot. Have you been involved with a project or advocating for more trees in your community?
I've been involved with forestry as a professional arborist for 45 years.
Oh, okay. This is your specialty. Thanks a lot, Gene, for sharing that. Peter, I know some communities have done this, more trees, more shade, trying to cool things off. There have been studies where, you know, if you don't work with local residents on maintaining those trees, explaining why they're there and things like that, it can be difficult to make these projects work. Do you have thoughts on successful ways to get those trees that communities need in place?
Absolutely, and it's a really important point. Working with communities and making sure that people understand what the benefits are is critical. Although in brutal days like what we're seeing recently, you know, the shade that they offer is something that people understand readily. And, you know, it's so important. You know, another important aspect of urban trees is their role in absorbing some of the runoff you get in increasingly heavy rain. So there are so many dimensions in which trees added to these neighborhoods that right now don't have enough canopy can benefit everyone across the city.
Thanks a lot for that call and sharing some of your professional expertise there, Gene. I appreciate it. We are talking about urban heat islands, parts of cities in particular, though, you know, maybe a smaller city, maybe even a smaller town might have some of this. Our guest, Peter Girard, his organization did a big study. Climate Central did a big study on cities around the U.S. It can vary 8 to 10 degrees difference from one part of a city to another, different at night and during the day. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is this a problem in your community? Do you have a question about how to solve it? Have you seen solutions in your own neck of the woods? You could join in at 800-642-1234 or email, share your experiences, email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let's see. We've got another caller here. Sue is with us in Richland Center. Sue, hi.
Hi. Last summer, during the month of August, we were in South Korea, in Suwon. Huge city, never felt huge. Really green, tons of green spaces, plants, pots everywhere. Any little open area where you could plant grass was planted. And even though it was sweltering hot, it felt very comfortable. And it also felt more like a small city instead of the massive city it is.
All right, Sue, thanks a lot for that question. And we've got Woonsup Choi back with us now from UW-Milwaukee. Our caller there, Sue, talking about examples in South Korea, actually. Woonsup, do you have thoughts on that? Success in communities there that have helped deal with these heat islands?
Sorry, repeat that question again.
Our caller asked about South Korea providing a good example of cities that have dealt with heat islands. Do you see examples in South Korea?
I haven't really heard much about it, but there are many large cities in South Korea, and then there are many also, I don't know whether it's unique to South Korea, but there are many different community centers where people can go and take a rest. And like air conditioned environment, and also in on the street, like say for example, large intersections when people have to wait for signal to cross the street, then there are some kind of shade, large shade under which people can wait. So that actually it is very popular during the summertime.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And Woonsup, when we lost our connection earlier, you were talking about the importance, the differences in temperature at night and how important that is for people's health and more. Can you talk a little more about your research and what you found with that temperature difference during heat waves at night in Milwaukee?
So I examined the heat stress conditions for Milwaukee and also Minneapolis areas. But so generally, what I found was that there are some the more incidents of higher temperature in the downtown area in both the cities, and that is likely to continue to increase over the next few decades. The limitation was that the resolution of the temperature data was rather poor. So thinking about the citizen science project you mentioned earlier, the resolution of the data is quite poor. So I could not have many data points within the city, but it is rather poor. So there are several data points that covers entire Milwaukee and also Minneapolis. So, but still I found higher temperature in the densely populated areas and lower temperature in the outlying areas. And also the number of days and nights that exceed certain threshold was increasing and is likely to increase in the future.
And our guest, Peter, mentioned earlier, people of color, people lower income tend to be more victims of these heat islands. When you dug into the concentration of heat in Milwaukee and Minneapolis, is that what you found there?
I did not explicitly examine that, but it is a widespread phenomenon around the world. Because when thinking about the trees, for example, there are more trees than parks in relatively affluent areas in many parts of the country or many parts of the world. And also thinking of the density of people and buildings in residential areas, availability of air conditioning, it is the impact is highly disproportionate.
Time for one more caller. Mike is with us in South Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just recently read about a professor and a series of graduate students who had developed a very, very highly reflective paint at Purdue, and that they were discussing the possibility of using the paint for the purpose of cooling buildings by painting roofs and things, exteriors of buildings, that the reflectance was so high that I believe it was over 98%.
I'm going to jump in because you don't have a ton of time, but Peter, your Climate Century report looked at albedo, the reflectivity of a community. Could something as simple as a more reflective paint make a difference potentially?
Absolutely, it could. That's something expressly addressed in the study. And I think your caller was getting to the idea that there could be a point where there's an unintended consequence where the reflectivity of the surface is so high that it's blinding people and causing additional problems. That's certainly something to be considerate of. But in general, lighter surfaces rather than darker that reflect rather than absorb, it can address at least some of the effect that you're seeing with this extra heat in places that suffer from it right now.
Thanks a lot for that call. And thanks to both of our guests for joining us today. We've been talking to Peter Girard. He leads digital communications and media relations for Climate Central. And Woonsup Choi, associate professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. They joined us for a look at urban heat islands and how communities, even within the same city, can have very different experiences of a heat wave. Very much a variation in temperature, daytime and nighttime.